From spam to speech, we're going to talk today about online content moderation, platform content moderation, and some of the challenges that platforms face in moderating various types of content that gets hosted or posted on different types of platforms. I'm going to take just a minute to set the context for this and also use this as an opportunity to introduce our panelists. I was actually first exposed to this topic by one of our panelists, Emma Lantzos, actually drew my attention to this topic several years ago in some of the public policy discussions that were going on in this area surrounding hate speech, terrorist speech, copyright, and so forth. And I was really intrigued by some of the problems that she talked about and that I think you'll get to hear about in this panel today. And I started to think about what the technical problems were that platforms faced in this type of automated content moderation. Since then, a lot has happened, both in the policy and legal space, as well as in the technical space, both in terms of automated detection and moderation of various types of online speech. And I think, as we'll hear from some of our panelists, not only on the detection side, but also on the adversarial side, new interesting applications of machine learning to automatically generate certain types of, shall we say, controversial content. So I've mentioned a little bit about how I was first exposed to this topic. Let me start with introducing Emma Lanza, who's second from the left, second from your left. She's head of CDT's, she's head of this Center for Democracy and Technology's Free Expression Project. They work to promote law and policy that support users' free expression rights online. She's done a lot of work in advancing speech protective policies, in legislative advocacy, and so forth, and also develops the organization's content policy, develops content policy best practices for internet content platforms in the industry at large. To Emma's right, to your left, we have Nick Sullivan, who's head of cryptography at Cloudflare. He's been head of crypto there since late 2015, and before that, he was head of security engineering at Cloudflare. Prior to that, he also worked at Apple and Symantec, and he's quite active in the ITF in various areas, and I've recently crossed paths with him on various aspects of privacy in the internet. Next to Emma, we have Amy Zhang, who is a PhD student in computer science at the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. Her advisor is Professor David Karger. So this is an interesting world coming together. My very first Usenix security paper in 2001 was co-authored with David Karger. So he was my entree to security as well. Amy works on designing and building systems to improve collaboration, discourse, and understanding on the web. And she's done recent work in looking at harassment in online forums, and I think she'll talk a little bit about that today. And finally, Ben Zhao is the Neubauer Professor of Computer Science at the University of Chicago. I think many of you probably know Ben's work. It covers a wide range of areas from distributed systems to human-computer interaction and applications of data analysis and machine learning to these areas. And he's recently done a fair bit of work in applications of machine learning to adversarial contexts in this area of online speech, in particular generation of deep fakes and other things that we'll hear about. Without further ado, let's turn it over to the panelists. I'm going to ask each of them to speak for about 5 minutes, and then we'll open it up for some questions. If you don't have any, I've got a list, but hopefully we're going to have a very active discussion in our 40, 45 minutes that we have. So I'd like to start with Nick over there to talk about you know, some of the challenges that infrastructure and platform providers face in this area and the different types of speech and content that they try to moderate.
Sure, thanks for the introduction. There are massive challenges faced by content platforms in terms of moderation online, and these can be handled in-house if you're talking about a very large content platform with sufficient resources, and in doing so, you can review it with an automated system, or more likely, you'll have a human-driven system for detecting and also dealing with abuses. These typically rely on user reporting. So if you think of the Twitter abuse report button, and if the scale of your platform is such that you can't scale the number of humans up with the number of posts or amount of user-generated content, then you often rely on user reporting for these things. And if user reporting gets to be large enough, then you can't even deal with that with a sort of collection of humans. You have to do this with automation. And this works on large platforms to some degree. We've seen some specific backlash to Facebook and Twitter and have seen how some of these systems have failed in various ways over the last couple of years. But this doesn't necessarily work on the broader web. There's no consistent use case. There's no Twitter report button for websites per se. So I hope to contribute to this discussion by speaking to the various parties involved in content, in getting content from content providers to users throughout the internet. And there are many different organizations and many different participants to the system. And these include, I guess, virtual private networks, hosting providers, registrars, reverse proxies, CDNs, DNS providers, etc. And these services deal with content issues in various ways and have different responsibilities. So I'd also like to explore in this conversation some of the differences between content moderation request types. If you think of what content should be taken down, there's various reasons why this should be, and there are different categorizations, and those include emergency requests, threats, phishing malware, DMCA, trademark, and sort of more general unwanted or miscellaneous content. So there's a lot of different angles to this discussion, and thanks for inviting me to the panel. I'm interested to hear what the rest of the panelists have to say about the technical challenges in this area.
Thanks. As Nick mentioned, my name's Emma Alonzo. I'm at the Center for Democracy and Technology. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we've got offices in Brussels as well. And my work as kind of an advocate for freedom of expression online deals a lot with kind of understanding what are the political and policy motivations that are pushing policymaking, here in the U.S., in Europe, and trying to get the best information possible in front of policymakers as they're deciding, you know, what kinds of regulations to pass, what kinds of laws to craft, but also what kind of best practices private companies who are also dealing with these problems can pursue. And one of the really concerning trends that we've noticed, especially over the past couple of years, is as governments around the world are really grappling with the issue that Nick mentioned of scale, the kind of the enormous scale of content online, the fact that it is impossible to do pre-publication review by a human being of all of this content before it goes live, unless you want to have review queues that last for years and years between trying to upload a file and actually seeing it posted. You're either stuck in a position where you don't have content policies or kind of review applied to most of the content that's online, or you're using automation to try to evaluate content before it goes live. For a long time, the balance that we struck, particularly in kind of democratic countries that were generally anti-censorship, was to let content get posted, rely on kind of notice and flagging systems, like Nick mentioned, and accept that that meant there was going to be a lot of sort of unregulated speech out there. The big concerning shift over the past couple of years is much more this sense, you know, from the United Kingdom and France all the way through to, you know, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan saying content should be filtered kind of before it goes live. The law should apply to content kind of consistently and comprehensively. And to do that, you need to use some kind of automation. We've seen automation and machine learning kind of pointed to as potential panaceas for all of these really complex content challenges, everything from hate speech, terrorist propaganda, disinformation, which, you know, step one, what do we even mean when we say disinformation? We saw it in the congressional hearings where Mark Zuckerberg was testifying earlier this year, where he kind of acknowledged that it's actually really difficult to identify hate speech through machine learning because of all of the complexities of defining what hate speech is. But almost in the same breath, he was kind of promising Congress that within 5 to 10 years, their AI systems would help detect all of the terrorist propaganda that was being uploaded to the platform. It's a lot more complicated than that, obviously, but we've seen a lot of governments kind of charging ahead with the idea that automation needs to have a big role in how we manage content moving forward. Just this summer, the European Parliament narrowly voted down a measure that would have required, you may have heard of the copyright upload filtering proposal that was before the European Parliament. The idea is not totally off the table, but there was a, you know, an intermediate victory this summer where the Parliament said, okay, this proposal before us to mandate that all content hosts use a, you know, some kind of content ID type filtering tool to identify whether copyrighted material is being uploaded to their services. That proposal was almost passed into law this summer, narrowly staved off, and is going to certainly be coming back this fall. So one of the projects that CDT has been working on is trying to describe in a lot more kind of precision and detail what is and is not possible with different types of machine learning tools and technologies. It's very common for everything to sort of get lumped in under the big broad umbrella of AI and really lose any of the nuance that helps you differentiate between, you know, the kind of automation that we've been using in spam detection and mitigation techniques for decades, from things like natural language processing to image detection to hash matching, in, you know, many different types of technologies. So we put together a survey of kind of the latest research in natural language processing, kind of taking the frame of a lot of governments and companies and people are interested in the concept of like a tool that could find all of the hate speech or toxic speech on a platform, to try to walk people through what are the reasons why those sorts of tools are a little bit of a pie in the sky idea and what the kind of inherent limitations are of these tools. But I'm at the end of my 5 minutes, so maybe that's something we can talk about in Q&A.
Hey, so as Nick mentioned, I'm Amy. I'm a PhD student at MIT, and I've been coming at this problem more from the HCI perspective. So that's led me to think about things like specifically harassment and some work on misinformation. And there's really two things that I want to sort of advocate for coming from the HCI side. One is that it's really important to go out there and understand people's experiences, the good people, the bad people, the sometimes bad people, like, and their motivations. So as part of my research, I've been interviewing a whole host of people who face harassment, all the way from people with, you know, millions of subscribers, YouTube stars, to just like regular people who have a stalker or have been caught by a mob for whatever reason. And one of the things we found out right away was that people get harassed online in all sorts of different ways, and they have all very different ideas about what is harassment. So, you know, it's not just messages. It's basically anything that can be pushed to a person can be weaponized in some way. So that's notifications, alerts, embedded images, subscriptions, even reporting, which is supposed to, you know, be towards against that, you name it. And then also, when it does come to message contents, so the text of messages, when we were looking at examples of people's harassment that they sent us, a lot of it is just really contextual. It's not the kind of thing where it's like, I see it and I can tell that that's hate speech. So I think this is kind of like an important nuance for people who do want to build machine learning models. It's like, really understand what your definitions are, because, you know, hate speech and harassment aren't actually the same thing. I think it's also important to learn as much as we can about the people who are harassing or others or perpetrating, spreading misinformation, and why they do it. Unlike spammers, some of these bad actors are not financially motivated. So in the case of harassers, sometimes, you know, you'll have victims who are subject to basically what's like a distributed denial of service attack on your inbox by a series of strangers. But there's also a ton of harassment out there that's like pretty personalized. Like just as an example, I spoke to one person who was getting harassed by her ex-husband. They shared a child together. They had to coordinate their schedules. And so he would use that information to basically send harassing messages exactly when she was in a business meeting. So, you know, unlike scammers, where it's more of like a numbers game, you're trying to hit as many people as possible, some harassers will really focus on an individual and be more adversarial in their attack. And that sort of leads me to the second thing I really want to stress, which gets to what we as builders and computer scientists can do about all this. And I want to advocate for more and better end-user controlled and end-user friendly tools and algorithms to combat this stuff. So, like, I think there's a huge need here because there's a lot of bad faith behavior that may not actually violate any terms of service and therefore won't actually be actionable at a platform or higher level. Partly because, you know, what is bad behavior, what is harassment can be personal and contextual, and partly because bad actors are pretty good at getting like right up to the line without actually crossing it. And I think we also need tools that are more customizable and transparent. So one of the takeaways I got from interviewing people is that they have very different ideas about how they want to actually respond to harassment. So for instance, just blocking harassers isn't actually a desirable option for many people. Like, if you're getting death threats or if people are threatening to dox you, you probably want to know about that as soon as possible so you can prepare for it, as opposed to just blocking these people. And then also, I want to advocate for tools that let people stand on the shoulders of other people that they trust. So we found in interviews that people were really overwhelmed by the work involved in dealing with harassment. So, you know, in response to that, in my group, we built a tool that lets people designate friends who can moderate their inbox for them. So this, you know, tool has like controls where you can, as the person who's getting harassed, you can still maintain control of your inbox while giving some permissions to people you trust. And we built this because we found out the number one way that people were dealing with harassment, other than just deleting their account, was to give their password to their best friend or their partner, and that person would then go into their inbox and clean it for them. So, you know, imagine if this sort of thing were easier to do, so you didn't have to just, like, start handing out your password to other people. What if you could, you know, as another example, what if you could fork someone else's blacklist and build on the one that they've built? Or in the case of misinformation, what if you could individually subscribe to the refutations of an organization that you like? So you can see those in your feed, for instance. So that last thing is something that I'm now working on as part of a W3C community group called the Credible Web Community Group. And I'm also a member of this group called the Credibility Coalition. We're thinking about technical standards around content credibility and decentralized ways we can convey things like trust. So, yeah, basically I think we need to understand users and use that information to tackle building more systems for users.
Okay, my name's Ben. I'm a faculty member working mostly in sort of empirical and experimental areas. So this is a really interesting panel because the dimensions are all different and we're all looking at sort of very similar kind of problems, but from very, you know, orthogonal dimensions, so it's really cool. So a lot of what my work concerns with is sort of trying to understand where NLP, natural language processing, and deep learning is, and in terms of complexity and ability, and what that means for sort of a lot of the real content generation and analysis industries out there. So a recent project that we did towards the end of last year was looking at, you know, trying to answer the question of if you took some advanced NLP stuff that we have right now, and if you took, you know, a bunch of machine learning results that we have right now, you know, how close can we get to human speech? And so the sort of the negative, well, the concerning result that we got was basically we could generate really, really convincing short snippets of speech that were basically passing the Turing test. So we were writing, generating automatically online product reviews for restaurants and such, based on training data, and you could put a real user in front of it, and they would not be able to tell the difference between that review and an actual review written by another human being. Okay, so it was passing those level of tests, but it was also to the point where they thought that it was as helpful as other real reviews, and so actually convincing and changing people's minds. So there's this sort of a dichotomy. There's a little bit of an asymmetry in where machine learning is right now, at least I think, from looking at some of the current natural language processing work, which is that generation of text is actually quite reasonable and it's quite advanced. And so we can take training data and you could generate reasonable text that looks really realistic. As long as it doesn't go on for like a page or something really long, you can make semi-coherent text out of nothing. The problem is that going the other direction is a lot harder. And so we found a lot of challenges in actually trying to analyze sentiment and analyze, you know, hate speech and other types of harassment because it comes in so many different forms. And so you actually need understanding of the language to go in that direction, but it doesn't require nearly as much to generate it. And so that's a challenge because right now, you know, so I gave this talk at this conference for investigative journalists in March in Chicago, and generally speaking, everybody was freaked out because for journalists, you know, this is sort of like, you know, they're bread and butter, right? The credibility. And so now that anybody can generate content automatically and to modify content, whether it's audio or video, there's a lot of recent work advances in that space. You know, how do you believe an anonymous source who sends you a content snippet and you have no idea whether it's machine generated or actually recorded, you know, of someone versus a, you know, some of these new audio things where you've seen Obama say things that he obviously didn't say and so on. And so, you know, there's a real challenge, I think, coming ahead for all of us because from the security community, one of the obvious things is things like, can you imagine a phishing attack, right? So phishing attacks today, you can get a phone call in the worst case targeting, you know, elderly relatives and saying, oh, your, you know, granddaughter so-and-so is lost south of the border, send money now. But it would be a lot more convincing, a lot more scary to have that phone call be accompanied by a video of that relative speaking in their own voice, telling the relative, no, grandma, I'm really, you know, I really am lost, or you got to send money, that kind of stuff. So real implications for security. And right now, there are no good answers from where I sit. Machine learning seems to not be able to detect bad content nearly as well as it can generate it. So that's my concern. And so that's some of the space I'm looking at.
Okay, I think we have about 15 minutes or so, so I'd encourage people to line up with questions if they have them. And while folks are thinking of their very good questions, I'll pose one to the panel. I think we heard some really interesting points here about what makes this problem so tough. There's huge scale. There's context, the problems of context. We're getting more powerful adversaries. And also there's the use of data to do like very fine-grained targeting, whether that be disinformation or harassment. So it's actually large scale and also in some cases very, very small scale. I guess I'll throw it to the panel. Like, what's the current state of the art in terms of, like, say, machine learning's ability to detect any of this? And pick your favorite, like disinformation, copyright, hate speech, terrorist speech. How good are automated algorithms at doing any of this? Which ones are they good at? Which ones are they bad at? And how close are we to where we need to be? I'll start with Nick, and then you know, I'd be interested in all the panel's comments. But a follow-up would be, you know, people are writing laws about this, so I would be interested in to hear Emma's thoughts on that with respect to the state of the art.
Right. So how close are we? I think not very close. I think if you talk about the narrow corners of this problem, we're very, very far away from having a generalized solution. When it comes to some things that, if you think of, say, copyright, for example, there are certain images that you can match by hash, and that's relatively efficient for a small set of objects. And if you get to the point where you're talking about everything that has ever had a copyright claim against it, doing that hash checking in a central location or in a distributed way is also just as simple as that. This is not even talking about machine learning. Is difficult and burdensome. So if you're talking about things that you're looking at different objects or images in the scale of millions per second, then it's completely inefficient. So for smaller sets of data and smaller sets of data to match against, you can do the most basic things, but compared to the cost of, say, so I work at a content delivery network, and every millisecond counts. So if you're transferring data through the network, any additional process that you have to do that is in line is detrimental to the performance and the bottom line. So it's very difficult to, without any a priori knowledge of things or some sort of input queue, to be able to do these general checks that actually handle very difficult problems in line and efficiently.
So, right, I think a big part of the answer to the question is in part about, like, how do you define the problem that you're trying to answer? How do you define, you know, what kind of content, what kind of tools or techniques? When we looked at natural language processing aimed at identifying things like hate speech or toxic speech, we found a number of different like surveys and meta-surveys looking at using different off-the-shelf tools, some of which were workbench tools where you buy this particular product and then train it on the data set that you were, or the kind of data that you were hoping to identify. And in a trained tool, we were seeing results of like 75 to 80% accuracy as far as identifying novel speech, and how well did that agree with what the annotators who'd coded the training data set would have said. Tools that were purely out of the box, you know, use them off the shelf, were, I think it was something around like 56 to 58%. Accurate, so in a lot of ways pretty much no better than a coin flip. When you look at, but if you define like a pretty specific goal, you can get to some pretty much higher numbers. So there was a news report back in the spring of the UK government had worked with a software development firm to develop a tool that was reported as detecting 99% of all terrorist videos that might be uploaded to YouTube or another video hosting site. After a bunch of media coverage and the kind of the UK government's initial like broadcasting, we have solved the terrorist propaganda problem. The company who actually developed the tool put out a very thoughtful blog post of like, There's been some questions about how does our tool actually work, where they radically narrowed the scope of like what was it that the tool was actually doing, and it was what they had developed was a way of identifying a particular subset of produced by ISIS videos that have certain kind of common characteristics, including sort of branding and look and feel and just their kind of the narrative structure that these videos take. So it's like really interesting research. They combine a couple of different like image and audio evaluation techniques, doing some pretty interesting stuff. But what they ended up with was a tool that was very good at identifying a particular subset of videos produced by ISIS, which is a much smaller piece from the whole terrorist propaganda kind of set of content. That hasn't stopped the UK government from leading the charge of saying, we need to have laws that require content hosts to identify and remove terrorist propaganda from their platforms within an hour of it being uploaded, which is essentially going to equate to a mandate for automated filtering. They're pushing this. A year ago it was 24 hours, then it got shortened to 2 hours, now it's down to 1 hour, really on no basis other than, as far as I can tell, kind of the political messaging that they want to say they're holding companies to account around hosting terrorist content. But as far as the technology goes, there may be some tools that can probably do a good job related to a type of content, but it's nowhere near close to solving the whole big thorny issue.
So when it comes to like toxic content detection, the one that I know of is Perspective, which is by the Google Jigsaw Project. And I think that one's actually in use right now at the New York Times for moderating their comments. So I think that there is some interesting work to be done kind of combining both human and automated moderators together. So I think in the New York Times case, they have human moderators, and they're using this Jigsaw API to be able to filter, but also sort what the humans actually have to look at. So that helps to prioritize their time. I think with all these things, you know, accuracy is a big problem, but I think another issue is, one, bias, and then also transparency. So, you know, it's difficult for a user right now to understand if they're breaking the rules because they don't know what the rules are in some case, and they don't know whether it's going to be triggered by an algorithm or not. And if they are, and it's an error, maybe it's a false positive, then there's not really any recourse to deal with that. And then on the issue of bias, so, you know, you have to be careful with these models because I think if you're not careful, a lot of times the people that are, you know, incorrectly swept up in these models will be oftentimes people out of the mainstream, minorities, people who are often the target of harassment in the first place. So all these things are things you have to think about.
Thanks. Yeah, so I'll finish up by saying, at least from where I stand, the technical solutions are really, really far. So certainly from a practical constraint, from ACI constraint, there are all these other things that you would like the solutions to have, transparency and applicability and real-time application. But just from a pure analysis standpoint, data-driven analysis standpoint, we are so far, so far away from actual understanding of speech and intent. Beyond just keyword filtering and simple structure. So, and that's assuming that we're just targeting people who are inadvertently saying things and they're not going to be reactive or adversarial. You put a terrorist or someone who's intent on passing a message, hidden or otherwise, and becomes order of magnitude harder. So, yeah, I think we have no hope within the next year or two of addressing those type of adversarial attacks. But certainly, I think we can maybe start to scratch the surface of, just regulating speech from a normal sort of people who don't necessarily intend to be adversarial.
Great. So with the remaining time, let's open it up for questions.
Yeah, thank you very much that we can talk about it here. I would like to know, is the whole thing we are doing here, except maybe for terrorism, a countermeasure for a symptom which is generated by our society? So don't we just contain something from society in technical boundaries, and does it make it really better, or can we just, should we not just only contain this problem but also address them by giving these people help, because frustrating or be angry or something like this, we're not gone by you are not allowed to post something here. So what are your thoughts on this topic? I know some of you are a technical person, but maybe you have to say.
No, I mean, that's exactly the right question to ask. And from my perspective, the kind of trying to control the online content piece of issues like hate in society is not where I would prioritize public policy focus or kind of taxpayer dollars, because as you say, it's like that is often a symptom of other issues that could be more meaningfully addressed much closer to the source. Now, on the other hand, there are certainly, and as Amy's been talking about, online harassment as a component of content moderation that's received a lot of attention. And there, I think there's certainly something to be said for the failure to address issues like harassment or hate speech online can also have real consequences for people, for their participation in public life, for their ability to express their opinions and ideas on platforms. So, it's not to say, as a free speech advocate, it's very easy for me to say, exactly right, we shouldn't be focusing on censorship at all. There is really something important in holding especially gigantic content platforms to account for the content moderation that they do and don't do and how that affects different populations of people. But as far as regulators focusing on national security and fighting terrorism, arguably the online content piece of it should not be the top priority.
Hi, thank you. So I think this is a great panel. Again, I work in this area daily, and I build tools and technologies to try to help companies protect themselves and individuals.
Could everyone identify themselves?
Sure. My name's Sam Small. I'm with ZeroFox. We're a local company. So we're actually pretty good sometimes at identifying these things very quickly, and we bring them to the door of the content providers or the content delivery networks, et cetera. And then you don't hear anything. And you can bring all of, you know, NCIS with you. I have every artifact, and I have every trademark and every copyright document, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously this goes, I think, across that. There's a lot of different areas here, whether it's, fraud, hate speech, cybercrime, malware delivery, et cetera. There's all these things, and they're all nuanced, et cetera. But you touched on this thing earlier. You talked about this law of, you know, where everything maybe has to be down in an hour. And I can tell you, and as I'm sure everyone on the panel knows, like, that just does not happen. Like, that's the mean time to respond is way beyond that. However, I am curious, Emma, on your opinion, and Nick as well, coming from Cloudflare, is there a future where there is something akin to an SLA of sorts when it comes to these things? And how do you see these things working? Because obviously, again, given the ephemeral nature of social networks, the impact is and the risk is highest closest to posting time. And so if you take down something, you know, 2 weeks later, if it's a phishing link or if it's something that's damaging to someone's reputation and isn't true, you know, the damage is already done by, you know, by and large. So I'm just curious what you think about, like, what do you think, is there something better than we'll get to it when we get to it, which is essentially what we have today, if they get to it.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, I think one of the challenges is actually getting a hold of the parties responsible, and this is an issue that we deal with sort of daily. The reports come to Cloudflare, and they're forwarded to the contacts that Cloudflare or whatever the content delivery network is, whatever the middle layer is that is not actually hosting the content but is the public face of it in a way, or at least if you're doing a Whois lookup or something like that, you'll see somebody because it's the part of the infrastructure that's actually closest to the visitor, the eyeballs. So actually forwarding that along is a relatively non-standard process, and it depends on the hosting provider, and it depends on the response of and the queue of whoever it is who actually hosts the content. So if we're in a space where we're talking about content platforms that have these systems in place and they are fully staffed and they're very aware of these sort of problems, they go quickly. But if you're talking about, say, a mom and pop hosting provider or, you know, a VPS that's on Amazon or something like this, it's actually it's going to require some serious changes, and the motivation for that change are things that have to come through various external means. They're not necessarily things that are going to be prioritized inside of a business. So I think there is a path to, you know, faster response times, but it's not necessarily going to be driven by the hosting providers themselves.
Are you calling for regulation here?
No.
No, but I think, I mean, to your point about, you know, market pressures aren't going to solve this problem for us necessarily, because companies have managed to scale up hugely without necessarily bringing their content moderation practices along. But I could, to try to be really quick, I could see kind of a couple different paths potentially for content moderation writ large going forward. One is the, like, keep hiring more and more people to do more and more content moderation. So, you know, Facebook's going to have 10,000 more people by the end of the year. You could see that path leading to a point where half of the world is employed doing content moderation of everybody's speech. maybe that's not the ultimate goal for humanity. You could see a path where it's like, okay, let's automate all of it. It's going to be error prone, but we'll agree to some kind of acceptable error rate. And you know, if you're in the already marginalized community, who's going to bear the brunt of that? Well, you were already marginalized anyway. I don't think that's a great answer either. So what I'm hopeful for is that we can focus on what are the ways to, through technology and law and policy, identify what's really the top priorities for platforms to be focusing on. How can they identify what sorts of things to prioritize from like a platform centralized enforcement perspective? So things like child pornography or true threats of violence, things where that imminence that you were talking about are really, really important, and have much more of what Amy's talking about of tools devolved to to users, that so that we can do the kind of more fine-grained shaping of our online experience that we want, and recognize that like prioritizing the worst of the worst or the most imminent issues is really where the resources of the content host should best be prioritized.
All right. Hi, I'm Kurt Thomas. I'm a research scientist at Google. And so I think it's great we have this call to action in the community for like, what can we do? But from both a policy perspective, I have a question on, let's say, does this expose companies to something more? Like, when you start to look, does that put you on notice, and what's the risk there? On the same side, like, given the interdisciplinary nature of this, like, we're in the abuse or security community, there's a lot going on HCI, where are the places we should be looking and having these conversations so that those who want to be part of this, we can learn from the lessons that are happening? So policy and how do we collaborate?
On the law and policy side, just on the law and policy answer, the question of legal risk depends very much on the legal system you're in. So here in the U.S., currently under Section 230 of the Communications Act, which protects content hosts and other intermediaries very broadly, for the vast majority of content, except for things that might be related to prostitution, there's no additional liability even if you have actual knowledge of particular content on your services. That all did just get much more complicated as of this spring when Congress amended Section 230 to create a new, very vague crime of facilitating prostitution. So that's a little bit in question even here in the U.S. Fortunately, the EFF, Human Rights Watch, and the Woodhull Foundation are challenging that law, so we'll see how the lawsuit plays out. But yeah, in a lot of legal systems, particularly thinking about the European context, it's a notice and action protection from liability. So if you are an intermediary and you're notified of potentially illegal content on your services, then you risk liability yourself unless you take action against the content. So the question of how much do you want to inspect material and do proactive policing is very much tied up in this. And whenever you kind of shift into that more notice and takedown sort of system, the risks of doing proactive inspection, certainly increase.
Yeah, and then on the question of how to collaborate better, I think there's just a ton of energy and interest in these topics. You just have to sort of get out of the space you're in and find those people. So yeah, in the past couple months, I've gone to journalism conferences, I've gone to policy events, and other academic areas that are interested in this area. So and at these events, it's like tons of people from all different spaces, and I think that's where you have to go to really understand the problem better.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I just wanted to, so sorry to the folks who are waiting in line. I wanted to just wrap it up, give people a chance on the panel to have one last word. So I'm going to end with a multiple choice question. Are we going to muddle along in the content moderation space, or maybe we'll see an advance? And what do you think is going to, if we see an advance, so muddle along is a choice, is it going to be, what's going to push us forward or create the inflection point? Is it regulation? Is it market forces, like some differentiator? Is it some public catastrophe? Is it advances in machine learning? Is it some public outcry? So quick, just, one phrase answer. What do you think is going to happen next? We'll start at the end with Nick.
Muddle along.
I think Europe's going to regulate something, and that'll have a big impact.
I think we need all the above, and I guess that's muddling along, but I think it's the right way.
Great. Yeah, I think we'll muddle along, but I'm hopeful that regulation will kick in from Europe or elsewhere to make an impact.
Okay, thanks. So thanks to all our panelists. I should say we were very fortunate to have people from really all disciplines on the panel here contributing a wide range of perspectives, and I think we're really fortunate to have the real thought leaders in this area. So I learned a lot from the panel. A lot of these folks have shaped my own views, opinions, and sort of insights on this problem, and I hope you all learned a lot as well. So let's thank the panelists for their time and for sharing their thoughts with us.